Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Marca Mesut Özil.
Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James.
We should make a badly morning jingle because we could use it a lot more. We would have got some real wear out of that this season.
I was kind of thinking about it. I was going, what could the badly morning jingle be?
Badly bad, badly, badly bad morning.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Something.
Oh, dear.
I was thinking more along the lines of Lady Gaga's Bad Romance, but...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Maybe that's not what we need to inflict on people after what was a difficult, terrible, disappointing, gut-punching, gut-wrenching, heart-rendering, heart-breaking, vomit-inducing, bile-tasting result at the Emirates last night. Does that kind of sum it up for you?
That's not bad. That's not bad. That was pretty much on the money.
That was off the top of my dome as well, freestyling.
Wow. Incredible. Rock the microphone.
Well, look, sure, we should just get into it, I think, because we've had some time to stew over this result, and there's no point going into small talk and all that kind of stuff. So let's delve straight into Arsenal 1, Olympiacos 2, team selection. Any surprises in there for you? Because I looked at that team last night and thought, okay, that's kind of what I was expecting. He's brought out his big guns, the attackers. He's got Ozil in behind. Ceballos has kept his place. Saka has come back into the team. Leno's in goal again. Like, this is, it looked to me like on paper, our strongest 11.
Yeah, of the players who are fit, I think that is Mikel Arteta's preferred 11. You know, he's got Mustafi back there alongside Luis, which he likes. Ceballos seemingly has the, you know, he's the front runner, isn't he, in midfield alongside Xhaka, ahead of Torreira, ahead of Guendouzi, and then that front four. Saka is the overlapping fullback and all the big names up front. So, yeah, I wasn't surprised. In fact, I'd probably go as far to say I was enthused by the starting lineup.
Yes, I was too. I looked at it and thought, wow, okay, he's having a real go at this. I do wonder if, after last night, this will be Mikel Arteta's preferred either formation or selection, because I think what happened in terms of the performance last night might have illustrated that there are certain things that don't go together. There are, you know, combinations of players that maybe don't work or can't work because of the form that certain players are in. But that's something we will come to a little bit down the line in this discussion. So team selection, we had no problem with that. The first half, I was doing the live blog. I was also writing the match report for Arsblog News at the same time, multitasking like a fox. And not much happened. Not much happened in that first half. It was really unimpressively dull. And considering the stakes and the occasion, that was a little bit worrying to me.
Yeah, I was in my seat in the North Bank, and so Arsenal was shooting away from me, which is always, you know, the less exciting half anyway, as far as I'm concerned. But this was particularly tepid, I would say. I think the only thing that sort of brought it to life, as far as I could see in that first 45 minutes, was Pepe, who I thought had some good moments. You know, I mean, he had that one where he went through on goal, didn't he, and was brought down. I've not seen that back, but I've heard it should have been a red card.
Look, I think if a guy is going through on goal and he's just about driving into the penalty area and he is taken out with a foul before he can shoot.
Yeah.
Like, if he'd been 2 feet inside the penalty box and the guy had chopped him down the way that he did, I wonder what the referee had been more inclined to give him a red card. I mean, to me, it was a red card. I think that should have been a red card, and I'm not for any second suggesting that that decision was what cost us the game last night. I'm just saying that on the basis of the kind of foul that it was and the passage of play and the fact that Pepe was going into the box, you know, he probably would have cut back, turned inside, turned around the other way, gone back, run into our half, run around Luis a couple of times, turned the other way, turned back, and then played a pass with his right foot out of play, you know. But
maybe the referee knew that. Maybe the referee was like, this isn't, he may be through on goal, but that doesn't mean this is a goal scoring opportunity. What if the ball is near his right foot, for example? We could be a full 20 minutes away from this man having a shot. I mean, the funny thing is that, you know, so I'm saying all that, I did think he was, in that first half, the guy who looked like he might make something happen. But contained within that, I think, is a bit of an admission that Arsenal's collective game wasn't really working, because it was his individualism or his ability to beat a man that looked like opening something up. I don't think our usual pattern of play across the team was firing.
Yeah, look, we didn't really have any incision, and I think last night was really strange in terms of the quality of the final ball. Once we got into their final third, once we looked for that final pass, uniformly it was awful. Like, not just from Pepe, not just from Ozil, from Ceballos, from Xhaka. I think Xhaka put in a couple of decent balls, in fairness to him. But, you know, the senior players who really should be capable of a lot better were not delivering in that final third, and it made it quite easy for Olympiacos. I accept the fact as well that they were very well organized. They sat deep. They made it hard for us, you know, to go through the middle. So we were working the ball left and right to try and open up a space for a fullback or somebody in a wide position to get in. They did that very well, but you know, there was a real lack of energy, I think, in that first half. And I think what was more worrying was the fact that I went, okay, look, I've seen this before. You know, not just under Mikel Arteta, not just under Unai Emery, but in football, where a team can have a poor first half. You go in at halftime, you're looking at what the opposition are doing, right? You're much more aware of what their game plan is, which isn't really going to change. And you come up with a plan to improve things and make things better in the second period. And you go, look, we need to do this, we need to do that. We need a bit more energy, we need a bit more aggression, we need, you know, all of those things together. Let's have a real go in this second half. And it was, you know, we didn't come out with a bang, we came out with a whimper, and, you know, one of those whimpers included their goal. So was that worrying to you as well?
Yes, it was. It was. And the other thing to say about the first half, because it improved a little bit in the second, is just that so much of our game going forward recently has been about getting Bukayo Saka in on that overlap. And I think Olympiacos were probably the first team who I thought sort of countered that quite well. You know, they had a guy playing right wing who had an even more absurd squad number than Saka. I think he was 97 or something like that. I'm not sure of his name. Let me have a look quickly. 97, Randjelovic. And he... man-marking is a strong word to use, but there wasn't a moment in the game where he wasn't looking at Saka and tracking his run and following his positions. Like, constantly his head was going to him. And I think, you know, that sort of slowed us down on that side. I, like you, had the same sort of thought of, well, look, Arteta's really got a tune out of this team in the second half before. We've seen him change games at half time. I keep going back to that Leeds match where he sort of broke that massive turnaround and we improved so dramatically. But, you know, it didn't really. And the goal, yeah, it was, I wouldn't say it had been coming, but certainly set pieces had been worrying me in the game.
Well, set pieces were a problem against Everton.
Yes,
at the weekend.
Certainly.
This one, I think, you know, you can look and you go, how far do you go back? I think maybe Bellerin could have been stronger in the tackle in the first instance. The corner came off Mustafi. And when you look back, and I've looked at, I've sort of done this to myself today quite a lot. I've looked at the goals and I've looked at them and I've watched them again and again and again. And each time I watch that second goal, it's like, oh God, I'm really, really not enjoying this.
Yeah, why are you doing this to yourself?
I wanted to analyze the goals and I wanted to look at what happened. I think we can see that the two players, I think it's Cisse and Ba, are at the edge of the area.
Yeah.
It looks really bad for David Luiz. But I think when you analyze the goal again, you've got to ask a question of Mustafi. He sort of leaves his zone to try and attack the ball. And in fairness to him, it's something that he has done well, you know, in the recent weeks. He's attacked the ball and been an aggressive defender. But what happened was he abandoned his zone, missed the header. The ball went over his head and there's a big space between him and Luiz. I don't think Luiz has a great deal of time to react. He just sort of waits for the ball to come to him and doesn't go for it himself. So, again, as we saw in that first goal for Everton, the space between our two central defenders was too big. And there was if you're a 6'6" central defender and you run in there into absolutely open space and the ball comes in, you know, it's just the simplest goal you'll ever score in your life. So I know people were looking at Luiz on the replays, but I think you got to look at Mustafi as well, that if he's going for that ball, he's got to get it, and he didn't.
Yeah, I also felt, and I know it's tricky because it's kind of a zone-based system, but they have two runners who come from deep and they start sort of up against Aubameyang and Ozil, I think.
Yes.
And Aubameyang does sort of go with his man, and to nobody's surprise, Mesut Ozil doesn't at all.
Well, he stands there. If you look at the replays, he's sort of looking to see where the guy is behind him. He's sort of looking behind him and doesn't even know the corner has been taken.
Exactly.
You've got to ask a question, don't you, of Mesut Ozil being used in that position, if that's what the organization is, if that's the way the team has been set up. Like, when they get a corner, we've got Aubameyang and Ozil who are going to track the runners. That doesn't make a great deal of sense to me.
And the two guys who ran from those positions were, I think, the two centre-halves who were their most dangerous players in the air. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if Olympiacos had watched what Arsenal do on set pieces and thought, here we go, you know, we could be in here.
Why wouldn't you?
Of course, you know, you do your homework. And nobody covered themselves in glory. And I think it was disappointing that we didn't seem to learn anything particularly quickly from the Everton game.
No, it's an issue that Mikel Arteta is going to have to work on in a big way. And again, the sort of the fallout and the consequences of this we'll talk about in a few minutes' time. So, look, 1-0 to Olympiacos, 1-1 on the night, 1-1 on away goals. And it's a really tricky situation, isn't it? Because you know that, you know, you've got to get a goal to win the game. But you also know that if you concede, you have to score twice because of the away goals rule. So it makes for a difficult scenario for the team to deal with. And I wonder if it was a little bit inhibiting. Nevertheless, from an attacking point of view, it just didn't happen, did it? We did have a couple of chances. There was a Lacazette chance maybe late in the second half.
Is that where he sort of went with his head?
Yeah.
It was quite low.
Yeah, it was like doing bizarre. That. It was like doing that thing you do when you're playing, you know, 3-and-in with your mates and you go around the keeper and you stop the ball and kneel down, head it over the line just to annoy them.
I mean, to be fair, I don't trust his feet either right now. So I sort of can see...
In seriousness, let's have this discussion then, because I think we're looking at pre-game Aubameyang, Lacazette, Ozil, Pepe, and thinking, okay, like, let's do it. But now, on the basis of that performance, I would be extremely reluctant to play that foursome again. And I think if I was being realistic, I think I would be picking one of Pepe, Ozil, or Lacazette, and one wouldn't be Lacazette at this moment in time because of the form that he's in. I know Mikel Arteta really wants to give Mesut Ozil every chance to contribute, but he's not. You know, the end product isn't there. And I do think there's just maybe something more to Pepe that we can get out of him if you can sit him down and say, just do it simple. Do the simple thing. Use your right foot every now and again just to lay a 3-yard pass backwards. You know, so, yeah, where do you stand on that? Because those are his, you know, on paper, big guns. But you can't keep carrying players who are in the kind of form that they're in. And I think Lacazette and Ozil... in particular, are really struggling for form.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a bit more positive on Pepe, because I think, as frustrating as his one-footedness can be, I felt like he might make something happen. And indeed, I think it was another cross from the right-hand side from him that led to the goal we scored on the night. You know, and that's been the same. He created goals like that against Everton and Newcastle.
Was it?
Apologies in that case.
Yeah, I think it was. You keep talking, I'll go back and look at it.
It may have been us, or that may be true. But I still have a bit more time for Pepe. I think that what's interesting is that with Ozil kind of playing as the closest player to Pepe on that right-hand side, we end up with two, left-footed players on the right wing. I think having one is great because you've got someone then who can go inside and outside. But with two who are always looking to come inside and without a right back necessarily pushing on, especially later in the game when we had Socrates at right back, we had Mustafi at right back, I think we had Luiz at right back at one point. We never had that balance. As for Lacazette, I mean, the guy's form is in the toilet, really.
Yeah. In the train spotting toilet, you know, that worst toilet in Scotland, the one where he goes into and it's overflowing.
Yeah, I mean, he's very much that. I mean, listen, you should never read too much into a player's warm up, but they were doing the passing and shooting drills pre-game, and I was watching, you know, Pepe go down the right and put crosses in, and Saka put crosses in, and they were putting crosses in to sort of like between the 6-yard box and the penalty spot. And Lacazette, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. He was sort of side-footing open goals, wide, high. And I was thinking, well, maybe this is a good sign because, like, you know, it's not happening for him in the warm-up. And his head would go down after each one. And I was like, well, I'm sure, you know, in the game when he's feeling sharp, feeling competitive, that might change. But clearly it hasn't. And he's a player who's desperately, desperately short of... I guess confidence is a problem for him now, but also just form, sharpness. He looks, you know, slower, a bit like he did.
Oh my God.
He's running through treacle, isn't he?
Yeah, he really does look like a guy who can barely get out of second gear. And I don't think he was ever the quickest player, you know, but he was certainly sharper in his movement than he is right now. The Lacazette that we're seeing now, and I know it's sort of open season on him a bit, but, you know, you can't help thinking that there's something really wrong with him, either physically or mentally. And I mean, in terms of his confidence and in terms of how he feels, you know, in front of goal. We saw how much he celebrated that goal against Newcastle. Yeah. Like a weight had been lifted from his shoulders. And then you think after the Olympiacos game, the first leg, you go, okay, right, well, he's got a couple of goals. This should like rebuild his confidence, make him feel a bit better. But there's just something physically not right with him, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not making excuses for the guy, but I feel like it wouldn't surprise me at all if we found out there was a physical problem there, because the sluggishness is reminiscent of during that first season, isn't it? When he was in that terrible run of form and then had to go and have a little op. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that, but that's how it looks. And I guess if it's not there, that's even more worrying because, you know, maybe there's the
psychological... Well, I mean, if it is there, why is he being picked as well? You know, if he's got a problem like that and they're aware of it and they're still picking him, well, that's sort of a mitigating element from his point of view, and it doesn't reflect particularly well on the manager. But... you know, after last night, I think he needs a good sit down. And I know he's been left on the bench for the Premier League games for Eddie Nketiah. And I'm sure that, you know, he's not going to play in the game on Monday night against Portsmouth. Look, it was a bad night for him. And I think one of the sort of recurring themes of discussion that comes up when we are analysing games under Mikel Arteta is the substitutions, and it's recognising perhaps things that need to change. What did you make of the changes last night? You know, I thought Lacazette could have come off at the end of 90 minutes, you know, if not earlier, and you could have made that change, put Martinelli on the left-hand side, move Aubameyang central, and see how you go from there. But there was also Torreira for Ceballos, which, you know, maybe it was a fitness thing. Maybe it was about, you know, just adding a little bit of extra energy to midfield. But we were playing the game in their half, and they were sitting extremely deep. You know, I like Torreira, but, you know, what does he do that's different from Ceballos in that role, in those circumstances? You know, he's tidy, he's quick around the pitch, you know, he picks the ball up and keeps it moving, but he doesn't provide any kind of, he's not going to split a defence open, you know what I mean?
No. I mean, he did have that one punchy shot, didn't he, from about 25 yards, but I found that a strange change, I must say. To be honest, what I thought there was that it was a bit conservative. Mm. I think, you know, it was 1-0 at that point, 1-1 on aggregate. And I think it was a change with Arteta thinking, if they score a second goal here, you know, we're in really, really big trouble. And I think it was a way of kind of steadying the ship. Not that we were rocking, but just, you know, there was a little bit of threat on the break from Olympiacos. Now, I would query that because I do remember, what was the game where we went down to 10 men? Chelsea, Aubameyang, wasn't it? No, that's not right.
Crystal Palace.
And Arteta said, I didn't want to make a kind of negative change. I'm paraphrasing here, but because I didn't want to send that message to the players. And yet I felt that Torreira for Ceballos was a little bit conservative.
I think that was the Chelsea game that he used that quote. I think
I'm
it was,
missing my messages.
Because remember they were talking about bringing Martinelli off.
That's it.
And he decided against that because of the message that he would send, yeah.
But I kind of had, I felt like this was a bit sort of contradictory to that idea. I was a bit bemused by the Bellerin change too.
Can you confirm something to me? Because it looked to me like when Willock came on that we moved to what appeared to be a back three.
That is right. So
I've seen people say that it was a back four, though, with Mustafi going to right back, but I just think he was playing on the right-hand side of that back three.
Yeah, and I said Mustafi as a right back earlier, but really it was a back three, and that was pretty clear. Arteta signalled a three to Xhaka, who stepped back into it. So it was kind of a 3-4-3. Xhaka and Pepe, I guess, were kind of wing backs in it. And I guess the idea was to get Willock on, you know, against tired legs. The athleticism of Joe Willock, you know, is an appealing prospect in some ways. He can separate from people and create distance, create space. And Bellerin as well looked short. And I think there was probably a reluctance to put him through 120 minutes.
Could you figure out exactly where Joe Willock was playing or what it was he was trying to do?
I couldn't either.
I couldn't either. I thought it was quite a strange substitution. I couldn't quite get to grips with that one. And then towards the end, of course, we had to put on Socrates for Mustafi, who got a hamstring strain. Do you think that might in some way have had an impact on Arteta making another change? You know, the Lacazette for Martinelli sub seemed an obvious one from an attacking point of view, but given the fact that he, you know, had lost a player to injury, he might have been a bit cautious about that, or?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there was cramping going on from quite a few different players, and Mustafi had been down a couple of times, I think, before he actually went off with that hamstring problem. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I'm looking at the bench now, and sort of thinking, we had lots of central midfielders on there. We had, you know, Torreira, Willock, Guendouzi, Maitland-Niles, if you want to call him that. Only Martinelli in attack. And Eddie Nketiah scored in the Premier League at the weekend, wasn't on the bench yesterday.
Reece Nelson, not on the bench.
Reece Nelson, not on the bench. I think the makeup of the bench is interesting. It doesn't look like a bench that was put together envisaging that we were going to be in this position chasing a goal.
Yeah, you know? I wonder as well if it was informed by the Burnley game, you know, where we lost Saka, and there was no obvious replacement for him at left back, and with no Kolasinac, I wonder if Maitland-Niles was there to sort of provide cover at left back if we needed it. We know we can play in right back as well. So
maybe it just feels like Torreira, Willock, and Guendouzi. You know, I feel like maybe we could have had another attacking option there. But Martinelli felt way overdue, because if Lacazette looked leggy, you know, in the 90 minutes. In extra time, that was just amplified, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And Martinelli, I think he provided a bit of energy, provided a bit of something.
Bright.
He did, looked really bright. I know he had a difficult game in the first leg against Olympiacos and was left out of the next game, but he just has that, you know, there was one where he sort of sprinted to keep the ball in their box, and you know, he was, if not necessarily involved in their goal, it was the fact that he was in the box challenging for a header, and the ball set up for Aubameyang. And like, what can you say? I mean, he's sort of gone from the sublime to the harshly ridiculous based on what happened towards the end of the game. But what an amazing goal that was! I mean,
incredible,
sensational.
Really, really was. And, you know, it's crazy, isn't it, how quickly the narrative shifts and changes. But in that moment where, you know, he leapt in the air and volleyed that in at the near post, I was like, wow, we are so, so, so lucky that we have Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And I think that's still the case, to be honest. I mean, we'll come to the miss, I'm sure, but it was a breathtaking moment. And the celebrations were massive. You know, I think there was huge relief in the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the relief of the crowd completely. Yeah. I just wonder if, you know, from a player's point of view, I mean, I get why they were relieved, and I get, you know, how much the goal could have meant. But I just think in the context of the game, you know, I wonder if we got a little bit too carried away with it. Maybe. Am I just being an old stick in the mud on this one? You know,
are you just being Roy Keane? I don't know.
I just feel like someone to say, come on, brilliant goal, but we've still got, you know, a very we're on a tightrope here. Still, we're winning, we're leading, but you know, keep your concentration. I understand, you know, the emotion and everything of scoring a goal like that at the time that you score it, and you know, had we not fucked it up towards the end, it wouldn't be an issue at all. You know, we wouldn't even be talking about it, but.
Of course, with hindsight, it looks a bit sort of hubristic as well. But it was kind of an amazing celebration. I think it's sort of worth dwelling on, because, like, the players were so exuberant. It sort of was unusual in that respect how much they were into it. And Lacazette, who, when he'd gone off, he'd sort of, you know, had a little word in Aubameyang's ear,
saw
probably
that.
Saying, go and score a goal. And then he was on the sidelines, absolutely, probably slightly relieved, to be honest, given the way he'd played and the chance that he himself missed. And I thought, I guess, how comfortable did you feel then once we scored that goal?
Like, I was relieved. I thought it was a great goal. I didn't feel comfortable. I can't say I felt hugely uncomfortable, you know, but I think there's a sort of fatalism that's built into us anyway, isn't there? That when you've got this situation, it's like, don't do anything stupid. And then you're thinking to yourself, stop being so stupid. This is Arsenal. Of course they'll do something stupid. That's what we do, you know, and then it's like, you shut up. You know, we're better now. And you've got this thing going on in your brain.
In a funny kind of way, it didn't change that much for Olympiacos, the goal. I know that, you know, they would have gone to penalties anyway, but if they wanted to win the game in normal time, or in extra time rather, they knew that one goal would probably do it. And kind of the way they played the whole 120 minutes really was, well, we're going to keep it tight and then we're going to attack where we can. Now, obviously, they had to go for it a bit more in that last period, but they kind of knew if we score, that'll probably be it. You know, obviously they weren't accounting for the miss right at the very, very end. But yeah, the set pieces had been the worry all night, and every time they had one, my heart was slightly in my mouth.
Yes, and mine was for this one also, and the fact that it was so unnecessarily conceded just made my made my heart sing.
Talk me through the concession, because it was, like I say, the other end of the pitch for me on quite a sort of horizontal plane, so I couldn't quite see what happened.
Right, so we have the ball on the left-hand side in the left-back position. I'm just going to describe it to you here as it happens. Where is it here now? So I think, do we even have a throw-in or something like that? Let me just bring it across here. Got the video. It's coming back. So here's the ball. There's a ball bouncing in midfield. It's flicked on towards our goal. Xhaka plays it back to Leno on his right foot. He takes a heavy touch and the guy closes him down. The ball rebounds off Leno and goes for a corner. I think Leno there, if he were to look at that, would say, okay, the touch I need to take is not towards the man who's closing me down. Yeah. Let me open up my body. I think he's distracted by the fact that there's two players closing him down, one from his left-hand side and one who's sort of straight ahead of him. So maybe that confused him a little bit. Nevertheless, it was a really poor touch. If he had taken the touch and opened his body out, he could have played it to Luiz and Socrates, who were there on the right-hand side. So it was a really bad corner to concede.
Certainly, yeah.
The corner itself, I think we deal okay with it because it could be, I think it's Martinelli who clears it with his head, and it's a good header away. We have the goalkeeper coming up. He's standing there. Torreira is marking 6 foot six Cisse. That's good organization. So Martinelli heads away. Ozil sprints out. The guy gets there, steps inside Martinelli. I do think Pepe could close the ball down more quickly. He just stands looking at it, and the ball as it comes in, again, the two central defenders, you've got to look at both of them there. I think Luiz, you know, he just sort of waggles his head at it. I don't think he makes any real
attempt.
He holds
a hand up, doesn't he? I think almost as if to be like, oh, offside, but I don't know. He half appeals.
I'm just looking at it again, hang on, let me see. Yeah, he has a sort of arm in the air as if like...
Oh, shit. It's the oh, shit arm, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the
oh, shit, please be offside. Please, sir, can that be offside? And Socrates, just too slow to react to the run of the guy. I mean, it is one of those difficult, you know, ones where the ball comes in and the guy is level with you. But when you look at the position... when you look at the position that Socrates was in, he has a look around, he sees who's there. The guy kind of runs off the blind side of him.
Arsenal's line isn't terrible, actually. You know, it's not like there's someone...
terrible, but like...
It's not like there's someone 6 feet deeper, do you know what I mean? Keep playing everyone on. But yeah, Luiz needs to be much more proactive there. Socrates just doesn't go with the guy. And... I suppose the last thing to say is it is a good ball. You know, it's a dangerous ball. But actually, do you know what? I'm watching it again. I almost feel like Xhaka could maybe do more. I don't know if you've got it in front of you. But
yeah,
as it
I
comes
do. I'm
in,
watching again. No, hang on. This is very fucking torture here.
How many times have you seen this now?
It's about 20.
Maybe it's over Shaka's head, but he's very static. He's on his heels as it comes in, you know?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I mean, you're right. It is a good ball in. It's one of those sort of the trajectory of the ball.
The corridor of uncertainty, isn't it?
The very thing. Exactly. So, you know, look, it's carelessness. You know, both of those goals that we conceded last night were due to, I think, fairly basic errors from our defending and basic, really poor error from Leno. Remember what I said to you the other day about Leno?
Oh, yeah. Remember you did. That? Shit.
Just
Andrew
about.
Knows. Hashtag Andrew knows.
And so you can look at the both of those goals and think, okay, you know, we could easily do better there. The question, of course, is why didn't we? That will be something I'm sure Mikel Arteta will take into account when he has his post-game inquest and you know, discussions with the players, because it's simple things. It's organisation. It's, you know, doing what you're supposed to do from set pieces. I think, you know, on the one hand, you might say, well, the solution should be obvious, but, you know, we're looking at mistakes from players who have made those mistakes time and time and time again in an Arsenal shirt. You know, an absolutely gutting time to concede a goal.
Yeah.
And it felt to me like, well, that's it. There's just no way. You know, we haven't created very much in this game. There's no way we're going to get another sniff of goal. And then, of course, we had that astonishing moment when Aubameyang, the ball fell from Ozil, put a cross in. I think one centre-half headed it off the back of the other.
That's right, yeah.
And Aubameyang turned, swiveled, and put it wide from, you know, just outside the six-yard box. For a guy who has executed the kind of goal that he scored, that overhead kick, the acrobatics, you know, the precision, the timing, all of that, you know, to score that first goal, to then miss what is, by any stretch of the imagination, a gilt-edged chance is just, it's extraordinary. It was one of the most extraordinary misses I think I've ever seen from an Arsenal player. And I don't mean this to be critical of Aubameyang, by the way. I'm not being critical whatsoever. I think he's, you know, he's a big reason why there's still anything left to this season. But for a player of his quality, is just amazing.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, as good as Aubameyang is, I don't think it's possible to sort of rewrite history and claim that he takes every chance. He's, you know, he throughout his time at Arsenal has missed some chances, you
yeah.
know, because he, by virtue of the fact he gets into so many positions, but this one, it was, you know, it was pretty presentable. And I don't know. I mean, he's an ice cool guy. I do wonder if sort of like, just kind of the chaos of what had unfolded in extra time, and maybe, you know, that was playing in his mind a bit. Mm. I mean, he celebrated his goal so vehemently, you know, I thought you really saw what it meant to him. And when Olympiacos equalised, he was pretty much on the deck.
He was, know, yeah. There's a picture of him just lying flat on the ground.
In the centre circle. I think he was just like, I think he was pretty crestfallen. And I don't think that's the best state of mind for any athlete to be in.
Yeah. Did you have some worries now about how this might affect him? Because he was very obviously distraught in his post-match interview, and he talked about how bad he felt, and you could see it on his face. You know, the players were coming over to console him. Bellerin came over to console him and walk off the pitch with him and everything else. I mean, do you worry about how his... how this might affect him in what's left of this season, because there are still Premier League games to play. We've really got to focus on that. We've really got to go for as many points in the Premier League as we can right now, because this avenue for European football is gone now. Is he you know, old enough, experienced enough, wise enough to not let this become something which weighs him down?
I think he is. I mean, I remember, of course, him missing the last-minute penalty against Spurs in the North London derby. And similarly, people, you know, were very critical of him in that moment, and there was sort of concern. And I seem to remember that he bounced back from that well.
Didn't he score a penalty in the next game? Was it against Man United? And it was the same.
It was certainly soon
it
after.
It was the same penalty that he missed, if I remember.
And you know, after that, he sort of carried on as if nothing had ever happened. And I think that's part of being a top striker, is that you miss chances, but they don't stay in your head.
Mm.
For me, and look, I might be applying a narrative to this, and I might just be over-interpreting things, but, you know, when I looked at how Aubameyang celebrated his goal and how much that equaliser hurt him, I had a strong sense that he kind of knew what was at stake in this game.
You're talking about the, you know, the possibility that Arsenal might achieve Champions League football by winning the Europa League, and thus, you know, his own future, of course, is an issue which is going to come into play here, because I think we can all accept that, you know, as one of the best strikers in Europe with 12 months left on his contract, if, you know, and the age that he is. I mean, we had this discussion in the last podcast that I think we basically said that Champions League football was necessary for us to, have a realistic chance of hanging on to Aubameyang, and B, being able to convince him to stay in the first place. So, you know, do you think that is something that went through his mind? It's like, I mean, I'm sure that's what he really wanted, was, you know, to help, whether he wants to stay or not, that's a different thing, but to help Arsenal, you know, win a European trophy that we came so close to winning last season, having got to the final.
Yeah, that was certainly how I interpreted it, yeah. And I felt like, you know, he scored a Champions League quality goal that seemed to be putting us, you know, on the way of keeping those hopes alive. And then it kind of all fell apart in that final 5 minutes. And I think that emotion was sort of, you know, etched into him in his post-match interview. I know it was about the miss, sure, and the disappointment, but I just felt like there were maybe bigger things at play. And, you know, there's an ambivalence, I think, naturally among supporters about the Europa League. And
yeah, let me ask you about that then. Let me ask you about that. That there is, if you talk about this ambivalence towards the Europa League, and I understand it, the Thursday-Sunday grind, you know, all the reasons that people might be fed up with the Europa League. How do you marry that with the outpouring of anguish and disappointment and in some cases anger, because that's people's natural reaction to a bad result and everything else, and some people lash out, and that's fair enough. You know, there's ways and means of expressing your feelings about a football game, whether it's frustration, whether it's antipathy, whatever it might be. But it seemed last night that all of a sudden there was this massive outpouring of, oh no, like our season is fucked, this is a disaster. And I can see that point of view. I mean, how do we add that up with this supposed ambivalence to the Europa League? Is it because we were so invested in the potential, like the long shot, and I think it was a long shot, of winning the Europa League and getting into the Champions League? Was it that we were so invested in that? Or was it because maybe we were sort of allowing ourselves to really believe under Mikel Arteta that this hurts because there's something to get behind again?
Yeah. I think it's that as ambivalent as we may be about the Europa League, we know the value of Champions League football. And we know it for what it means for the club, the status of the club, the finances of the club. I mean, as we've been talking, the club have published financial results, which show...
Oh, shit, have they?
Yeah, so they've published accounts for 2018-19, which show a loss of 27 million. Bear in mind, the previous results, I think, showed a profit of 56. Now, a lot of that is player sales from that previous year. They took a lot of money in the transfer market for people like Oxlade-Chamberlain, stuff like that. But, yeah, they're not great numbers. It's, you know, if you speak to people at the club, there isn't a huge amount of confidence that there is a lot of money available. Look at the January transfer window for further evidence of that. You know, being in the Europa League at all, makes the club about £40 million.
What does it mean? Get to the final. If you get to the final, sure. You earn it's. I think it was about 36 million euros. If I remember, Swiss Ramble did something on this. A little bit less than that because we were beaten in the final. So there are. I mean, okay. We'll talk about the playing implications now in a second. But there are very definitely financial implications of not making progression in this season's Europa League, which are going to have an impact on what we do or can do in the summer, lest some kind of benevolent owner dip deep into their pockets, which seems unlikely when there's a stadium in Los Angeles that's costing more to build than fucking 100 spaceships. It is going to have an impact financially on the club. I think there's another sidebar issue to this as well, isn't there? That season ticket holders are entitled to 7 games.
Absolutely.
7 cup games on their season tickets. That hasn't been fulfilled.
No, so there will be a rebate, I believe, to fans at the end of the season, which will cost the club a fair few quid. So, yeah, I mean, look, how realistic it was for us to win the Europa League, I don't know. But I think given that we got to the final last year without a team that was especially great, I think there was hope that Arteta could do this and pull this off. And I think he sensed that as well.
Yeah, maybe. I think that, I think that's the glass very, very half full outlook on it.
Oh, yeah, that's the fans' primarily way of thinking. I think,
sure. I think if you were to step back at it and look at it objectively, you would say that it's a rookie manager who's taken over a team that was in an absolute fucking mess. It was a shambles. The whole club from you know, top to bottom was in the mire, you know, when he took over. So, you know, the fact that he's stabilized us and brought about a change in attitude, a change in results, you know, not a significant change in the results, but some change. And certainly there's a lot for us to get behind and to hope for. I think for that guy with this squad to win a European trophy in his first, not even his first full season as a manager, his first few months as a manager, to me seems completely unrealistic. So while it was really frustrating and disappointing to go out last night and to go out in the manner in which we did, I mean, we can't be overly vexed by the fact we're not going to win the Europa League. I don't think. Anyway, maybe that's just me.
Look, I would love Arsenal to be in the Champions League next season, even if I agree it would be well ahead of where we are in our development. You know, and we'd probably get absolutely the shit kicked out of us by any half-decent team in the Champions League group stages. But, you know, at some point we do need that revenue and we need that boost. And the sooner the better, the longer we're out of it, the harder it gets. And I think we all just wanted, we all saw the Europa League for what it is. It's a shortcut, isn't it? In the game of snakes and ladders, it's the ladder that takes you higher than you would otherwise go. Mm. And it was probably the most plausible path, unless, you know, Arsenal get very lucky with the legal stuff with Man City, to that actually happening in a season which has been basically a disaster. So it was a way of saving the season and making it, all that terrible stuff that happened in the first few months doesn't actually matter because now we're back in the Champions League. That's probably gone now, I think.
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think, again, if we want to step back and look at things, we have to look at how the season got to where it did, to the point where it did, where you know, the fact that, you know, after just a couple of months in charge, people were letting themselves think or hope or believe that we could win the Europa League. Look, I'm not saying people should temper their expectations or that they shouldn't believe. Like, what the fuck else have you got if you can't believe in something or hope for something? You know, that's a huge part of being a football fan. But you know, picking up those pieces and then fashioning them into a side that could win, you know, a European trophy, something which Arsenal haven't done since 1994, it should be pointed out, you know, with a manager of far greater experience at the helm for 20-odd years, Arsene Wenger couldn't win a European trophy, you know. So I think...
I agree with you. And I think it was probably always unlikely, but I would say, and this isn't to be overly critical of Mikel Arteta, I would say that an Arsenal team with a 1-0 lead from the away leg against Olympiacos at home should probably go through that time.
No, I agree with that. I do agree with that. It was a bad night. I think this is going to be a game which has a significant impact on Arteta from now on. I think we're going to see him make some changes to his team, because I don't think, you know, he can put out his big guns, but if they're not delivering for him, he's going to have to go a different way. I think defensively, he's got to try something else as well. I think at the center of our defense, we've got to try something else, because, like, as good as Mustafi has been in the last few weeks, and I think perhaps his redemption has been overplayed a little bit. At the heart of it is a guy who's been really bad for us for a number of years. Luiz has had some good performances, but, you know, we saw last night, and even I think against Everton, a player who maybe he's tired. He's played a lot of games. You know, his passing is off. His concentration is off. Those things which, if they're 1 or 2% off with David Luiz, they look like they're about 50% off. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's going to have to maybe bring in the new guy, bring in Pablo Marie, and let's have a look at him in the FA Cup game on Monday and see what he's like. I don't know that he can play that four together again. I think he's got to leave Lacazette out of the team for a little while. I'd like to see him, as much as I enjoy Eddie Nketiah and seeing a young guy come through, I would rather see Aubameyang play as our centre forward and Martinelli play from the left-hand side, because Martinelli is a 10-goal or 10-11-goal player so far this season, you know. So I think it might well be a game which has an impact on him and how he views some of the players in this team. And to me, this is going to be the most interesting part of what happens after this. Like, there was always going to be a bump on the road, wasn't there? You know?
Yeah.
We hadn't lost since the Chelsea game. We'd been unbeaten in 2020. I know we hadn't won as many games as we would have liked, but, you know, as much as winning becomes a habit, not losing becomes a bit of a habit as well. So what the response is to this, how he picks them up, how he picks himself up, and how he tolerates any kind of misery is not the right word here. But, you know, there's no way that he can allow anyone who's feeling sorry for themselves to play in this team. You've got to, you know, pick yourself up and get the fuck on with it, because there's still plenty of points to play for in the Premier League.
Yeah, I was really struck. I expected Mikel Arteta to come out in the press conference and sort of give his team shit, like, you know, call them out a bit. But it was really telling that straight away he was saying, you know, I'm proud of them. I want them to pick themselves up. I think he senses that he's got a job on his hands to lift them at this point. And I think you're right to flag this as a game that will be significant for him, because something that I think we are not used to, and who is used to it, having a manager who has never managed before, is that we've got a guy who is learning and needs to improve and needs to get better. And as painful as an experience as this was, and as familiar in some ways as it was for us, it is new to him, and it will change how he tackles the job, how he approaches the job in future. It has to.
No, I agree. I agree. And I think, you know, maybe it's a testament to the work that he's done that people are so, you know, unhappy or so gutted by what has happened, because maybe they expected more, and that's okay. You know, I'm not saying that they shouldn't, but, you know, I think when he took over, people were sort of saying, look, whatever happens between now and May, que sera, sera, kind of. Because it's so bad that whatever we can do to make things better from here, you know, we can live with that, and we can use these 6 months as a kind of a learning experience. And, you know, it'll be beneficial for Arteta. He'll get to know the squad. He'll know who he can count on, who he can't count on, all of those things, at the same time as him getting that vital experience under his belt as a manager, you know, on the sidelines, game after game after game, like he's literally learning on the job. I think there was a widespread acceptance that that is kind of the way that the rest of this season would go. The difficulty, of course, is that when you lose a game in the circumstances in which we did, it's very difficult then to rationalize that with the sort of the visceral feeling of losing a game in those circumstances, isn't it? You know, you can step back and say, okay, well, you know, we all said, but at the same time, when you get fucked by a last minute in injury time goal, last minute in extra time even, you know, it is normal to be absolutely distraught about that.
And it was kind of a double punch, wasn't it? Because there was the winning goal and then the miss. It was like, you know, left them right. It was pretty heavy double blow. So, yeah, I think that's it. And I think all the frustration and the anger is actually just sort of the reality of the situation coming home to roost, and the timing of these financial results the next day. You know, I don't think, I mean, that's the third blow, isn't it? But it's like, it really makes you realise where we are. We can't sort of kid ourselves on that we're going to get this magic pass back into the Champions League. You know, we're in the shit, basically. And yeah, we might pull something magical out of the bag between now and the end of the season. Personally, I don't hold out a huge amount of hope for that. I just think there's sort of too much competition, really, and it kind of would it would require a run, the nature of which we've not seen this team produce for quite some time. So, yeah, I think it's just, it's the chickens coming home to roost. It's a real reality check.
Yeah.
And
it is a bit
that's
of a, yeah,
the disappointment.
It is. It's a reality check. It's a kind of slap in the face. It's a waking you up from this kind of, I won't say daydreaming, but, you know, to an extent, I think that might be the case, that we sort of, yeah, let ourselves believe certain
honeymoon
things.
Honeymoon period, maybe.
Honeymoon period as well. Yeah, all of those things. So, look, it was a painful night. A painful night, but we've yet to see what the response Mikel Arteta can elicit from these players in these circumstances is. This is kind of like, okay, we had the Chelsea game, didn't we? Which was, you know, that was a bit heartbreaking as well. But I think this is even more so because, you know, the potential reward and everything else.
Yeah.
Right, will we take a break and come back
Let's
with questions?
Let's take a break. Yeah.
Let's take a little break. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog. Also on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsblog, and on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. Can I ask you a question first?
Of course.
Do you ever like work late after a football match or whatever, and you lie there in bed trying to sleep and you can't sleep because you're too wound up, and
oh yeah, all the
you're
time.
Replaying incidents of things in your head, and you go, why didn't you just do this, you fucking, and then you're sort of lying there and then you get a song in your head and you get the snippet of a song in your head, just one line over and over again, and you can't sleep because the song is going on and the song is... That happened to me last night.
Oh, no. And what was the song?
Sweet Caroline. Dun, dun, dun. I think the players deliberately chose to lose so they wouldn't have to hear Sweet Caroline.
It's very possible. Yeah, Amy Lawrence said that was the one silver lining for her.
Oh,
that,
God.
That we didn't have to hear Sweet Caroline. I mean, yes, I'm sorry. That's not the song you want to get stuck with, is it?
It isn't. But hey, right.
Apologies to any Carolines out there.
Or Neil Diamond himself, of course.
Shall we have a question?
Yeah, let's have one. I'll start from Richard Estrada, who's at Lance Striker 6. He said, I'd love your thoughts on the inability of Pepe to pass the ball in a timely manner. Had guys cutting the entire match and couldn't or wouldn't hit them in stride. Really frustrating.
Yeah, he reminds me of Pepe. I think when we bought him, I sort of thought we were signing like a sort of Salah-esque, sort of like goal-scoring wide player. He reminds me of Riyad Mahrez quite a lot. You know, that tendency to sort of do the drag back, the step over, the other drag back. And I think like Mahrez, he's a bit of a wild card, really. You kind of never quite sure what you're going to get. I think Mahrez has become more kind of systemized at City.
Well, you have to be, don't you, under Pep? Because otherwise he'd be so angry. So angry to Riyad. I'm very angry. So angry.
And I guess that's what gives me hope, because the talent is there. And I think if Arteta can kind of work a similar trick, but... Yes, look, there was a pretty absurd case. Was it in the second half yesterday where he sort of, I mean, did check back five or six times, and people in the crowd were absolutely astonished the amount of time
is
he checked back.
Is that a diplomatic way of putting it, James?
Oh, incredibly diplomatic. I mean, when something big happens live at a football game, something happens where people turn around and sort of look at the strangers behind them with their arms outstretched as if to go, what the fuck? Do you know what I mean? And that's what everyone was doing.
Yeah.
It was that thing of like looking at each other being like, what are we watching here?
What I can only imagine happening?
It was similar for you in front of the TV?
Yeah. I mean, there was that moment you're talking about where, I mean, in fairness, he beat about six men. It was like some of it was extraordinary, but like had he released the ball a bit sooner, I'm pretty sure we could have, you know, caused them a problem. As it was, he held on to the ball so long, Olympiacos got pretty much every man back in the box. So you cut off all the avenues again. I think that is going to be something that that Arteta thinks about, you know, is how quickly his players move the ball.
Mm. Yes, I agree. I think there are a lot of players who are quite slow to make the decision to release the pass. Arteta does this thing on the touchline when he gets really wound up, where he kind of moves his hands in like a little mini circle. And what he's saying, I think what he's trying to say is circulate the ball quicker. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So like he's sort of spinning a little circle with his hands, and he did that a lot last night.
Yeah,
a lot.
I can imagine.
He wasn't happy at the speed the ball was moving. And I guess that you'd have to say that's the case for quite a lot of guys in this team. You know, Pepe holds on to it too long. Xhaka sometimes holds on to it long. I think even Sabas can hold on to it too long.
Mesut Ozil, you think about the incident in the Everton game where the ball, you know, he took the ball out of the sky and then just stopped.
Yeah,
it was like,
exactly.
No, play, go forward, use the ball quickly.
Exactly. And I think Pepe's a tricky one because I do, like you said, he did beat the man about five times in that moment. You know, he can do it.
Mm.
And I think he produced a very good save, I think, from the goalkeeper at one point. He made a couple of decent saves, that keeper. But yeah, it was frustrating too, wasn't it? And I do think that combination of him and Ozil in tandem is maybe a bit problematic because they're kind of looking to do similar things. I mean, I still think Pepe was sort of bought not as the same type of player, but as Ozil's replacement. I think, you know, when they thought about what this team might look like in the summer, I do think they were thinking 4-3-3.
How much do you think they thought about it? Genuinely. I mean, how much do you think they thought about it? I mean, we know they were after a winger.
Yeah.
Because they were pursuing Zaha. But Zaha and Pepe are quite different.
Yeah, and they are best on opposite sides as well. Maybe not, or certainly I was looking at it then, put it like that, and thinking that's the obvious way this plays out, and Ozil will be kind of the odd man out. But obviously, since he's come back into the team, that's kind of changed. What do you think about where Pepe is right now?
Like you, I can see the talent. I think there's a need for him to, I mean, you don't want to cut all of that out of his game, right? Because that's what he's good at. We don't really have anybody else who can beat men in the way that he does, but it's about being aware of all the other stuff that's happening around you. Like, it feels to me like he's trying to beat men for things to open up for himself rather than beat men for space to open up for other people, if that makes sense. Like, I do think there's a simplicity that could be introduced to his game which would make him more effective. Even a couple of times, and I've noticed this not just last night, but a couple of times in the last few weeks, that even when he's playing a short pass to somebody where they're sort of tippy-tapping the ball around the right-hand side, the weight of the pass is not right. Like, he can leave it short, so he has to go rescue it himself, or it puts the other player into a little bit of trouble. So I think if they can introduce some simplicity to his game, I do think as well that it's very difficult to play him and Ozil and Lacazette in the same team because I'm just not sure there's enough end product there. Who are they going to invest in between now and the end of the season? Who might the investment of time and minutes benefit the most next season? And for me, it's fairly obviously Pepe.
I think so. I mean, you know, we talk about end product, but, you know, he had a goal and two assists against Newcastle. He had an assist against
Everton. Yeah.
You know, he's been a bit better in that regard.
Yeah.
He'd be the guy that I would be persisting with. And I think, yeah, the constant beating of men last night was frustrating, but I sort of think it kind of came out of necessity because, you know, what we were doing collectively wasn't great and wasn't working. Mm. But, you know, what I think I said it on the last show, Mikel Arteta, I've heard him shouting Nico Simple. And I think last night there were sort of about 50,000 Arsenal fans in the stadium shouting Nico Simple too.
Mm.
You know, he's got a way to go. He's got a way to go.
The thing is, though, you know, it kind of feels like he might be the easier one for Arteta to drop, and I hope that isn't the case, you know? Because you can see those elements of his game, which are, you know, I think Lacazette has played himself out of the team. Ozil does a lot of stuff that's very tidy, but not necessarily that effective anymore. Whereas Pepe, you look at him and you go, oh, God, you know, just... You can understand why he frustrates, but you know, if you really do want to prepare your team for next season, give him as many minutes as you can, and try and like polish off some of those rough edges between now and May, and go again.
Yeah, you've got to try and wring what you can from the massive investment that we've made, and you know. Mm. He is as important a project as anybody in this team. Let's have a question from the Discord. It's from Sunny Cool. And Sunny says, last night was a huge moment for me. With Champions League highly unlikely, more quality will probably leave the club than come in the summer. I've always put our potential up there with Chelsea and United, but for the first time ever, I'm starting to feel like we can only just compete with the likes of Leicester and Everton. I've never felt this low about our potential before, ever. Whilst any fan of any club can dream, do we as Arsenal fans need to seriously lower our expectations?
Yep. I think so. I try and I want to look at things from the most optimistic way. What I look at is a club that has been on the slide for a number of years. And in recent times, that slide has become more obvious and more marked. I worry about the overreaching strategy. I worry considerably about the people who are running the football side of things at this club. And, you know, I'm sure there are eyebrows being raised here and all kinds. I'm not going to go off on a rant about Raul Sinyahi. All I will say is that, you know, if you're in a setup, right? If you're in the kind of setup where you have a head of football, somebody who is directly responsible for football matters at the football club.
Mm.
I wonder would in any other business producing the kind of results that Raul Sanyehi's overseeing of Arsenal's football strategy has produced lead to the situation where the guy keeps his job without any question. Like, is football a strange, weird industry where you can be the head of football and appoint three or four different head coaches who all fail, and yet you get to pick the next one?
Well, you know what I mean? Wood springs to mind.
Yeah, you know, so there's this sort of veneer of executive protection that I don't think is that healthy. And I think I worry a little bit that perhaps Josh is in thrall to Raul and his experience and his you know, I'm sure he's a smooth talker, as we've seen. Well, not that smooth. He's quite a rough talker. But, you know, I just worry. Like, I think Josh is more involved and wants to be more involved and clearly wants to do more with Arsenal. But, like...
Mm.
I just have serious worries about the people who are running the club. And I, like, this isn't about Arteta, by the way, and like, I'll give them credit right now for the Arteta appointment, because I think, you know, again, he's somebody I really want to believe in. I like what he says and what he's doing and everything else. But I think the squad building, some of the dealings that we do, there doesn't appear to be a real strategy in place, or not one that's been communicated to us about where the club is going, where it wants to be, beyond these sort of peripheral or these vague ideas of competing for the biggest trophies, as we keep saying, that KSE, you know, talk about. So yeah. I think we are in a situation where we're going to have to take stock and think, okay, you know, we've got some way to go. Like, the idea that we might be back in the Champions League was one that kept us all going, because instantly our status would be restored, that this thing that we all enjoyed and experienced for years and in some ways took for granted, you know, was back, and that's it, problem solved. So maybe last night, as hurtful as it was and as painful as it was and as disappointing as it was, is a reality check, not just to Mikel Arteta or to Raul Sanyehi or Stan Kroenke or Josh Kroenke, but to us as fans as well. That they've got a lot to do, James, to put things right. And we're asking the people who made things wrong to put them right. Now, maybe anyone can make a mistake and you learn from your mistakes, etc., etc. But I'm not filled with a great deal of confidence that the guy who wanted to give Unai Emery a new contract is some kind of footballing mastermind.
No, nor I. I mean, the only thing I would say is that I think this trajectory has been in place. It predates them. You know, we've been...
Sure.
It predicts Raul, certainly, you know, in that we've been in decline for some time. It doesn't predate KSE, I would say.
No, I think it's very, very strongly connected to KSE. And maybe it's a coincidence because the Wenger era came to an end and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, since they took 100% ownership of the club...
It's not been great.
Mm.
Yes, I think that's true. In terms of our expectations between sort of, let's narrow it to kind of between now and the end of the season, what do you think, what are your expectations for what the rest of the season might hold?
I mean,
do you think there's any possibility of qualifying for the Champions League through the Premier League?
Can I look at the table?
Yeah. It's 4 points to fifth, and it is 7 points to fourth.
On paper, not insurmountable.
Realistically,
no. Is it just going to be another thing that we dream about, though? And then when it doesn't happen, we get unhappy and sad because we couldn't produce. I mean, look, maybe we had a question or two here, I think, on the Discord. One is from, I should have worn my glasses. GM Lig, I think it is, apologies, who says, given Arteta has a week to prepare for each game now and the players have less time to fight for or play games, do you think it's possible they could sneak into a Champions League spot? And Vidur says, given we're out of the Europa League, how many points realistically out of the 33 left to play for would be a good end to the season, irrespective of where it puts us on the table at the end? We're a team that's won, what, 8 Premier League games this season? We've got 11 to go. I think if we win 5 or 6 out of the 11 that we've got left, draw a couple, lose a couple, I think that's probably what we're about set up for. I mean, I'd love it to be more. I'd love for us to, you know, go on a run and everything else. But I think we have to be realistic about what this team is capable of.
Yeah. And I'm just having a look now at the fixtures and seeing what remains. I mean, we've got to go to Spurs. We host Leicester. We host Liverpool.
Ooh.
So, you know, there are some tough games there. I think that we can probably accumulate more points and enough points to overtake. With the greatest respect, we might overtake Wolves because, you know, they're going to carry on in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sheffield United have been great, but who knows if they can sustain it.
I don't think they will. I think they're the classic newly promoted side who have been really good. And, you know, we know firsthand how good they are. I think we've seen this before with teams like Wigan. I remember one season having a stonking season, and then towards the end, you know, all the effort that they put into becomes attritional.
And they're at 40 points now, so there's that, you know, that sort of psychological barrier is there, so maybe they might just take their foot off the gas a bit. But we still need to catch and overtake Chelsea, Man U, Spurs. That feels like a big ask.
I can't see it. Realistically, I can't see us. I mean, I'd love it. Don't get me wrong. I'd absolutely love it. But I just, realistically, I can't see us producing that kind of consistency.
I hold out more hope of finishing above Spurs than I do of us getting into the Champions League.
Would that be, in the circumstances, trifling as it is in the grand scheme of things, would that be a successful end to the season?
Seventh is a trophy if it's above Spurs.
Yeah.
Well, look, I would take it, I think, in the circumstances. I mean, we have got the FA Cup still to contend with, and it's a competition that, you know, we have great history with, as does Arteta. So that would be cool to go deep into that competition and have a Wembley showpiece and, you know, hopefully in the final. So that's kind of a separate thing, though. You know, that doesn't change anything dramatically for us, I don't think. You know, it's not going to fix the mess we're in, I don't think. It will feel nice, but it's not going to financially or status-wise or in terms of keeping players do very much.
No. Do we need to qualify again for Europe? A lot of people ask this question, so apologies if you didn't. I didn't, get your name out. But do we need to qualify for Europe to make or to consider the end of this season in any way a success, even if that is just the Europa League?
So personally, I think we do need to qualify for Europe. By hook or by crook. I know there are people who say, well, look what happened to Chelsea when they were out of Europe and in mid-table, and look what happened to Leicester, they won the league. I just think, first of all, you've got to bear in mind the different financial situation that Chelsea were in at that time, where, you know, Abramovich was still willing to put money in, and it wasn't, you know, too problematic for them to not have European football. We do need all the revenue we can get. I also think, you know, I think there are players, and I'm not just talking about Aubameyang and Lacazette, who, if we don't have any kind of European football, might question that. You know, do those contract negotiations with somebody like a Bukayo Saka become a little bit more difficult?
Yeah.
I think arguably so.
That's a fair point. I hadn't considered that, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, you just think in terms of a player who might look to move or might consider moving, being able to say, well, I want to play in Europe, it's a pretty big crowbar in those negotiations. You know, it's a pretty big piece of leverage. So I think we do need to do it. What about you?
Yeah, look, I just think on a very basic level, European football and the revenue that it generates is important for a club, which is, as we've been made fully aware today, struggling from a financial point of view. A comment here from Sir Chips at the end of the financial results, which you can read on the official Arsenal website. Our player training profit for this financial year was limited, and this combined with a second consecutive season of Europa League football, remember this is about last year's revenues and this is our third year, has meant that the club recorded its first overall loss since 2002. For 2019-20, we will see increased commercial revenues from Adidas and our renewed deal with Emirates. Like, it's not, I mean, it's some money, but it's not significant, not hugely significant, particularly if you need to spend money in the transfer market on top of everything else. And he says, but another season outside the Champions League will continue to apply pressure to our financial results. And I remember Vinay talking about this very clearly, that it costs us tens of millions of pounds every season being out of the Champions League. It costs us in terms of prestige. It costs us in terms of recruitment, in terms of player retention. You know, it is the holy grail of you know, European football. Like it or not, that's the reality of it. The Europa League is a poor relation, no question, but it still provides European football. It can provide experience for young players, as we've seen in the past, and it does provide a measure of revenue that the club appears to really need. So I think we do need to finish. And we need to qualify for Europe one way or the other. Because the FA Cup winners get into Europe as well.
I agree. And I think, you know, we've got a pretty big squad. And actually, as much as we complain about the schedule, I think, you know, we need to offer some of those players some game time. And I basically think the Europa League, for all its problems, it is a lottery that you can't resist but buy a ticket for, because you might win a Champions League place. And Arsenal needs to be in that lottery.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
There we go.
Is it your question or mine?
Not sure. It could be though. So
okay, here's one. Here's one from Nick Bright at Nick Bright DJ.
Oh, this is what I was going to do, yeah.
He says, I know in the grand scheme of things it doesn't matter. Also, I ask this without an ounce of sour grapes. Not even a little ounce. Anyway, he says, what do you make of some people arguing that away goals after 90 minutes shouldn't count? We had 90 to get our away goal and they had 120 minutes.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's one of those where kind of the longer it goes, the more it favours the team who play the second leg away.
Didn't we lose a Carling Cup semi-final to Wigan? On away goals at Highbury or the Emirates?
I think at the Emirates early on, Jason Roberts. Maybe it was Highbury, actually.
Could have been Highbury, yeah.
It was a semi-final. Maybe it was the last season at Highbury. Not sure, but it does seem a bit odd, doesn't it? I'm trying to work out if it is sour grapes on my part. I don't think so. It feels like it should be scrapped after extra time. After 90 minutes.
I think the away goals rule should be scrapped entirely.
Do you?
Yeah. What's the point of it?
I think it's sort of historically, didn't it? Sort of, you know, when home and away were seen as more determining factors.
Yeah.
It kind of encouraged
away teams that went away from home to attack.
To attack. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's no longer really the case.
No, it's an anachronism now. I think it should be absolutely and completely scrapped. Why there's no real justification. You know, the whole point of football is to kick the ball in the net. But because of some arbitrary decision, the same thing can count double. It doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't make any sense. You know, why should your goal be twice as valuable as mine?
Yes, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, what I will say is that I quite like the drama it sometimes provides. I'll hold my hands up to that.
Okay, when it happens to other people?
Yeah.
But not when it happens to us.
So can we have different rules for just for us?
Just for us, yeah. All of our goals count double in all of our games. We have decreed this to be the case. Therefore, we should be world champions. But no, realistically, I get rid of it. I just get rid of it. You know, a goal is a goal. You score a goal, it should count as a goal. Where you score it is irrelevant.
I hear you.
Do you get like points for artistic merit?
Well, I think the away goal is the most celebratable kind of goal. Like, if you score an away goal in Europe, you know it's big. And I do enjoy that moment. But of course, yeah, when it goes against you, it's absolutely horrible. And I agree with you, rationally, it should probably go. So, yeah, actually, you know, we were robbed. We were absolutely robbed blind. Turns out we were robbed. Okay, let's have another question. This is actually from Lucas85 on the Discord. And Lucas says, can we now already call the signings of Suarez and Marie a total waste of time and money, given that they were loan signings to bolster our season and our season is now over?
I could be a bit harsh on Marie, because I think the idea for him was to bring him in now and let him, you know, ease in. And I think we were always going to make the deal permanent, right? As far as Flamengo are concerned, this deal is done. They've moved on. They've bought a player to replace him. Yeah. I think the loan thing was probably some financial hoo-ha that I don't know the ins and outs of, and that I suspect that he will become an Arsenal player on a permanent basis at the end of his loan deal. So for him, not so much, because I think we use the next few months to sort of bed him into the team and get him fit and everything else. It's a shame he's not fit. Hopefully we'll see him on Monday. I'm very curious to see, you know, what he looks like and what kind of a player he is, because, you know, we've all heard the interviews and heard people talk about him, but not too many of us have seen him, unless you're a keen studier of Brazilian football, or you watched a lot of the Spanish second division. So, you know, from that point of view, I'm hoping to see him. The Suarez thing, like, how is a club that is financially challenged, would it be fair to say?
Yeah.
Why are we signing a player, paying a loan fee for a guy who, I know we have an issue at right back, but like, I worry about...
He's not even available to solve it. I mean...
Yeah.
Look, it's called the January transfer window. On Sunday, it's March. He's not been available yet.
Mm. Exactly. Exactly. So I think, you know, again, maybe it's a case that they want to bring him in. They want to make the deal permanent in the summer, you know, because he's out of contract, so he can sign as a free agent and what have you. So maybe the thinking there is, okay, we bring him in and he can get used to everyone and join the group and settle in and all that kind of stuff. And then we sign him and he can be, you know, a competitor for the right back position. But right now... Yeah, it's hard to look at those signings as or that particular signing as one which is in any way beneficial to us.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think I always felt the Suarez deal was a bit odd and a little bit unnecessary. I think, you know, Pablo Mari is a bit different. You know, he I think we needed something at centre half, and I think when he's fit, he will get game time. Actually, I think he will get some minutes, and it won't feel completely pointless, and I agree with you, it'll probably become a permanent deal in the summer. So I think, yeah, of the two, that's the one that sort of makes more sense.
Okay, here's one from Nathan Wise, who's at Nathan_Wise17 on Twitter. He says, Lacazette has been under some pretty harsh criticism lately, and although he's hit a bad patch, he scored some important goals for us in big games. Spurs, Liverpool, Atletico, Valencia. How would he be viewed in 10 years if we were to sell him in the summer?
Interesting question. I actually had this one from Peter Host, who said, this might be an unpopular opinion, but is it fair to say that Giroud was a better striker than Lacazette? 0.41 goals per game versus Lacazette's 0.39.
Whoa, he's 0.02 better.
Well, interesting though, isn't it, that we sort of bought Lacazette as a kind of more prolific forward, theoretically, and it's not quite panned out that way.
Yeah, I think he's a Giroud-level forward without necessarily the range that Giroud has.
The physical differentiator as well, you know.
Yeah.
Like Giroud provided an option aerially in a way that Lacazette doesn't.
Mm.
I think Giroud's hold-up play was better. I think... Their finishing is kind of similar, sort of hit and miss, to be honest.
Giroud is more spectacular, capable of more spectacular goals than Lacazette, I think.
True, and I think Giroud's combination play is... Well, I think Giroud's combination play is pretty exceptional, to be honest. I don't think many people are as good as him in terms of holding it up and laying it off and all that kind of stuff.
Like, if you were to ask me right now, you know, choose between Lacazette, who's whatever he is, 28?
Yeah.
And 28-year-old Giroud?
Oh, yeah.
I'd have 28-year-old Giroud every day of the week.
I think I would as well. And I think, you know, the differentiator was supposed to be Lacazette's being quicker. You know, we all lamented that Giroud was slow, but, I mean, Lacazette is not quick.
No.
He's not quick at all, really. So, yeah, interesting. I also think that Giroud would be a more obvious foil for some of our other attacking players.
Mm.
So, yeah, I thought that was an interesting comparison. As for Lacazette, what was the first question? It was just sort of, should we take him out of the back and shoot him? What was it?
It was, he's had some pretty harsh criticism.
How would he be perceived if he left now?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating one, isn't it? I mean, extraordinary to think that in May he was our player of the season, and that wasn't a decision that provoked a huge amount of dissent. You know, he was talked about as a potential club captain as well, I remember, in the summer by a lot of people. This season it's really, really fallen away from him. He's had a pretty poor season all in all. And I think, unfortunately, if he was to leave at this point, I think there's always a recency bias. You know, the way you played before you left the club often influences things in the short term. And I think, given the outlay, I think he would be regarded as a bit of a flop, really. And I don't, you know, it doesn't make me happy to say that, but I think we spent a lot of money on him.
Yeah. Like, if this form doesn't pick up between now and the end of the season, if he bangs in a few goals between now and the end of the season, people will, remember him a bit more fondly if we were to sell him in the summer. Yeah, I think I had another question about Lacazette, but I can't. Oh, yeah. Ken Kratz fan. He's a fan of Ken Kratz, whoever that is. Do you know who Ken Kratz is?
No.
Should we Google him and find out? I mean,
Ken Kratz. Ken Kratz. Okay. He's a lawyer.
The former district attorney of Calumet County, Wisconsin.
Stephen Avery.
It was that fucking thing, yeah.
Netflix documentary.
Netflix, yeah.
Making a murderer.
Make a podcast. Make a podcast about a serial killer or a criminal and just leave it open-ended. Don't worry about it. Forget about the victims. Don't worry about them. Just make sure you can sell fucking MailChimp subscriptions, you motherfuckers. Anyway, he says, if Aubameyang left this summer and Lacazette was willing to sign a new contract on his current wage, would you give it to him or look to sell?
I think you would sell, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think
How old is he?
28?
Yeah.
At what point does he become 29?
What because are we getting for him if we sell him? Yeah, that's very true. He's 29, actually, at the end of this season, 28th of May.
Until then, though, I believe he remains 28.
What are we getting for him, money-wise? Do you know what I mean? That's part of my consideration.
2 years left on his contract. Still
40 million? Is that a bit much?
Well, that's take 30. I think we might get 30. If he doesn't remind people of some of the quality that he has displayed during his time at Arsenal, then, you know, 30 million I'd take.
Here's the thing. I think there'll always be a route back to him to somewhere in France, you know, especially there's always talk about Lyon potentially selling Dembele, and he would, you know, could potentially come back in. The trouble is, if you lose Aubameyang, and I think increasingly that is likely, sadly,
yeah.
It worries me slightly, given, and I know Lacazette's end product has been really poor, but it worries me slightly that, you know, as much as we might like Martinelli, or as much as we might like Nketiah, and even to a certain extent Pepe, there's no track record there. So I suppose my answer is, I would sell Lacazette, but I would want at least one new striker, probably two.
Well, remember when we sold Van Persie and we brought in Podolski, and Cazorla. So it's not impossible to to bring in or to completely revamp your forward line.
Yeah. Basically, I really like Martinelli, but I'm not quite yet ready to be like, we can sell all the strikers and it'll be fine.
No, he's too young. He's too young. Yeah. You know, it's a big...
He's a kid.
Big responsibility to put on a young player like that. And like you, I'm very excited by his potential, but we have to be realistic. Like, if you play him week in, week out, and he, you know, struggles, people will be the first to say, look, what are you doing? He's just a kid, so...
But, you know, if this is the last... This might be the last chance to get some decent money back for Lacazette, so, you know, it would be tempting. And the way he's played this season, he's not been worthwhile.
No, I would sell. I would sell. Even if Aubameyang left. Actually, especially if Aubameyang left, because I think then you just go, fuck it. It's time. We just go in a completely different direction. We rebuild as much as we can within our resources, of course.
Well, also, if you sell them both,
yeah,
you've got plenty of money swilling around to get
yeah.
you know, some bodies in and somebody pretty good as well.
Yeah, and maybe George Mendes and Kia will tell us that they've got
some of that sweet cash.
They'll allow us to sign one of their really great players.
Yeah.
So that'd be
for
good.
A small agent's fee of just small. £20 million.
Yeah, £20 million paid in 5 installments of £100 million over 1 year.
A Southampton striker, Shane Long. They can get a Shane Long.
right.
Yeah. Anders Magnusson, who, in my opinion, sort of has the sort of Scandinavian version of your name, which I enjoy.
Hello, Anders.
Can you please talk about Joe Willock? Why do all coaches favour him? Can't see what he offers the team, especially not over some other players.
Well, we talked earlier, didn't we, about where exactly he was playing.
Mm.
And we didn't know or quite what he was being instructed to do either.
Yeah.
I think they like his athleticism. I think they like his willingness. I think he's a good player. I think he is a good young player, but maybe one that's suffering just at the moment for not having a particularly defined position, you know? But I think in the Premier League and in football in general, the ability to run and to sprint and, you know, we've referenced the Liverpool midfield before, haven't we? That they're not necessarily the most brilliant footballers in the world when you stick in Henderson and Wijnaldum and mm-hmm. whoever the fuck else they have in there. You know, I try not to think about Liverpool too much. But, you know, they're not necessarily the greatest players in the world, but what they can do is operate well within a system. And I think Willock is a player who could be that kind of a player if that's something we were building. But, you know, he's a young talent. Their form and what have you is going to fluctuate. I don't think he's been... I think he had a much better first half to the season than he's having a second half. But... Yeah, look, they're seeing something in him. They're definitely seeing something in him.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is that he's kind of the only midfielder of his type that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that plays into it. You know, if you're looking for someone who genuinely does give you that ability to separate from defenders, to, you know, sprint and dribble away from them in sort of central midfield areas, I think it's sort of him, really. Like, that's it. And if you want to find someone to do that, that's who you've got to go to. So I think they'll be looking for someone of that category, of that type in the summer, who's a bit more experienced and a bit more ready for those minutes. So, yeah. But Joe Willock doesn't vex me. You know, when
no,
I see Joe Willock
neither.
Come on, I'm like, that's fine. And I don't come away from games being like, what the fuck's Willock about? I sort of just see a young player who's promising but raw.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I mean, I do wonder why, what it is they're asking him to do and how it is they're asking him to do it, you know. He does seem to be kind of thrown on as a kind of agent of chaos in some ways, you know.
He does. And there's good and bad to that. And, you know, like Diaby or sort of almost Baptista, like he's one of those players, sort of, what's his position is really sort of hard to say.
Yeah.
And that can make him dangerous, but can also make him frustrating. And you hope those things iron out, but
yeah.
maybe they don't.
Okay, I've got one final one here.
Go on.
Assuming I can find it. It comes from Dan, who's at DanFizzle49. And he says, last night's Aubameyang stunner was so good, I prematurely announced to everyone around me that I was naming my firstborn Pierre-Emerick. What's the best meaningless Arsenal goal you've ever seen?
Ooh, good question. Probably something in a friendly or a testimonial or something.
I think we've got to use a competitive match because all of those goals don't count, you know, so...
So like a consolation, I guess.
Yeah.
God.
There was one that stood out to me immediately.
Go on. What is it? I can't think.
Do you remember when we got beaten 6-1 at Old Trafford?
I mean, I try not to.
The Igor Stepanovs.
Yes, of course.
Adventure, as it was that day. I think they scored first, and if I'm right, we scored an equaliser. And it was a really brilliant goal. Was it Perez? Henry, they worked the ball. They worked the ball down the right-hand side, and it was just a lovely, lovely work.
Henry
goal.
Scored, yeah.
Henry scored.
To make it 1-0. Oh, that was a good choice.
Really good goal. I was thinking, whoa, that's a good goal. And then, of course, by the time Dwight York has fucking scored the fifth with his cock, you're like, fuck this.
That's a pretty good one. I can't better it, to be honest.
Iwobi in the Europa League final was a good one.
Oh, that's a great shout. That's a great shout. And sort of one of those where, in a weird way, you kind of felt he could only do that in a situation where the game was dead. Yes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
But there you go. Yeah, that's... I'm sure he treasures those memories.
All right, well, look, we'll leave it there, will we? Because we've gone through it all as best we can, and hopefully you've come out the other side of it feeling... I don't know what you're feeling.
Probably nothing. Probably dead inside. Numb.
Yeah. If you're all dead inside, we'll start a podcast about it and exploit your death so we can sell mattresses and those food packages that people get. What's that about? Just cook some food, you fuckers. All right. Well, look, we've got a FA Cup game on Monday, so Arscast Extra on Tuesday.
Yes.
We'll have to wait until then to discuss our hopeful progression in the FA Cup, and hopefully this competition will do more for us than the Europa League has done this season. Thank you as ever for listening. Thanks to everybody, by the way, for all the really nice messages for the Arsblog 18th birthday thing that was doing the rounds yesterday. Thanks to Arsenal Football Club, my team. Thank you for making the day so special. I really appreciate it.
A special delivery.
Special delivery of a big bag of shite.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. Really, really appreciate it. And we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.